Hi, it's Scott McKinnon here from Monstars MMA. We've got a special guest from all the way from Australia, Brianna Bowley. I hope I said that right. Who's a mindset coach for combat sports athletes, along with many other things. So I'm going to pass you over to her, and I'm going to let her introduce herself, and we'll take it from there.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for having me on to begin with. I'm really stoked to have a bit of a chat with you. I guess to tell a little bit about me, where do I even start? You've kind of covered it. Yeah, I mean, I work in mindset and more recently a little bit of embodiment work with athletes, entertainers, entrepreneurs. My specialised niche is martial arts, because that's kind of my greatest love. Everything's centred around having my clients show up as their best version of self, and as a result, hopefully get in there and achieve whatever their individual goal is, whether that be, you know, obviously in an athlete sense, getting the win or, you know, getting the championship belt or whatever it might be. I think that kind of covers it.
Good stuff. So how did you actually get to the point of knowing that that was kind of what you wanted to do? Was it like sort of like a gap in the market of you knowing yourself that you could help these athletes from obviously like from the highs of winning to the lows of losing, like you said, like a championship belt or losing a fight or getting themselves in that mentality to even get in there and do stuff?
Yeah, so I guess for me, I mean, I was a personal trainer to begin with, got into a variation of bodybuilding myself. So I was fitness modelling or competing in fitness modelling competitions, and went through obviously the dieting struggles, the mindset struggles, the competition struggles, you know, dealing with a loss, all of that sort of stuff. And from there, found myself getting into, that's when I personally found martial arts. So I got into kickboxing. Found myself wanting to train for a fight, but was kind of struggling between managing my workload and having, at that time, you know, I'd kind of transitioned into the mindset coaching, but I was working with, you know, sort of anyone and everyone. And so I was trying to juggle working with clients with also my own training. And, you know, I guess came to realize that not only is that something that so many athletes struggle with, you know, balancing work as well as their training, but also through the training process, you know, for my own kickboxing, I noticed how much, you know, it is such a mental game. So I kind of started to go, well, hang on, I'm doing all of this mindset-based work for your everyday kind of person. I wonder whether it would work with athletes. And so I started to kind of dive in, started to work with like football players, you know, Aussie rules football, tennis, all sorts of different sports. Reached out to, and I'm sure you know the name, I reached out to Jessica Rose Clark, who's now in the UFC.
Yep.
She kind of agreed to be my combat sports crash test dummy, so to speak.
Your guinea pig.
The fight that I worked with her through was her preparation for fighting against Karina Dam, who, and I believe that was Titan FC, and like the difference between, you know, Jessica Rose Clark before, you know, in her previous fight and that fight was like chalk and cheese, you know. So I kind of went, well, holy fuck, I'm really, I hope I can swear on your show.
Yeah, that's fine.
I kind of went, okay, cool, like I'm really onto something here. And, you know, I mean, she said that she felt like a completely different person in there. So the passion was kind of born from there.
Yeah, just touching on like what you're saying about the workload and stuff like that. I don't think people realise like, obviously you've got like your MMA fans and you've got your average Joe people who just watch like certain events or things like that. They don't realise how much goes into preparing for a fight, like you said, with managing your own workload. I mean, I think it's a good 90% of fighters that aren't at the top of the game have to work full-time hours. And like, I've gone back to training just recently and going to work 40-45 hours a week, obviously traveling to and from work whilst training and stuff like that. It does take it out of you mentally and physically, because you get the bug of what you've wanted to train, you wanted to try and be the best that you can. And obviously, you've still got to do a full-time job, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, it's beyond a full-time job, you know, the preparing for a fight, the training, the recovery, the nutrition, like it's full on. And I think, as you said, a lot of people don't actually realize just how extensive it is.
Yeah, they kind of just think that fighters, all fighters, whether you're pro or amateur, that you're full time, and that's could be further from the truth, from what it is. I mean, I know a lot of people that do PTs and things like that. I remember one, you won't mind me mentioning him, is Corin Eaton, who fights over here. He used to fight for Cage Warriors, and he was working 40, 50 hours on a building site. So it wasn't as if it was like an easy job he was doing. He wasn't going and sitting at a desk. So he was having time after training to recover and things like that. And most pro fighters try and train 2 or 3 times a day. Obviously, because you have to be at the top, so you have to train as much as you can to the best of your quality you can. So it's either trying to get them in during your lunch breaks or when you finished your 8, 9, 10 hour shift to try and then find the energy and the motivation and the actual energy to go and train.
Yeah, absolutely. It's full on. And, you know, and obviously we've only got 24 hours in a day. So to do all of that, plus make sure you're getting adequate sleep for recovery, you know, plus getting in the nutritional needs you need for recovery, all of that sort of stuff. It gets really tough to balance it all. And that's why, you know, it's important to have every aspect of your life as streamlined and in check as possible, so that, you know, it all kind of works together as a nice, well-oiled machine, rather than, you know, all kind of fighting against one another.
So from your own personal experience, going from, like you said, your fitness modelling, your bodybuilding and things like that, to your kickboxing, did you just see that, not in a bad way, that it wasn't going to go as far as you wanted it to, and that you thought you'd be better at the mindset side of things? So you veered your career into helping others more than not yourself, but obviously you knew you were going to help yourself as well, because I know you get a lot of enjoyment from what you do. I followed you for, I think it's just over a year now, and you're constantly smiling, you're constantly happy. And when you're seeing people succeed and things like that, you can genuinely tell that it makes you so happy that you're actually helping these people, knowing that even if they're a little 1% or 2% better each day, you're doing your job.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess for me, when I was personal training, you know, I was working with a mixture of high-level athletes, as well as I worked with a lot of, like, weight loss clients as well. So I'm talking, like, you know, 50-plus kilo sort of transformations. And what I noticed time and time again was that it didn't matter how much we changed physically, if our mind wasn't in check and wasn't in alignment with what we'd created or what we were looking to create, then it didn't actually matter how much, you know, physical transformation there was or how well we were performing physically. You know, the mind's kind of the powerhouse. And so I remember one particular day, a client of mine, he'd dropped from 130 kilos down to 80 kilos. And his next goal was to learn how to do pull-ups, right? And I got him on, I don't know whether you know the machines I'm talking about, but they're like assisted pull-up machines where you sort of, you know, you've got the counterweight and whatever else, and you kind of like you kneel on them, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, like we're kind of going to progress our way up. We're going to start here and then, you know, build our way up from there until eventually you can lift your own body weight. And he went to jump on the machine and he was like, oh, I don't know about this. And I could see he was really cautious. And I kind of said, well, what's going on? He's like, I'm going to break it. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, I'm too heavy. And I went, well, hang on a sec, mate. Like you're 80 kilos. Like you're probably slightly below the average male's, you know, weight.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely fine. So in his head, what I realized in that moment was he was still walking around at 130 kilos. You know, he was a 130 kilo man trapped in an 80 kilo man's body, right? And not long after that, he actually ballooned back out to, I believe, above 130 kilos. So he almost, you know, backtracked in terms of his progress. And so it made me realize, you know, just how much it's the mindset that really matters. And so from there, it started off just a process of wanting to be able to help my PT clients as much as possible by giving them the missing piece. And then I realized through that, that, you know, the mindset stuff was really, that was really my passion more so than the physical training side of things. So, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously with you saying something like that, like he couldn't get over that because obviously he'd seen himself at 130 kilos, but he actually wasn't. So how would you start the process and things like that, just to give obviously like the listeners and stuff a bit of, because obviously it could potentially help people as well where they've cut weight and they don't see themselves as that weight. How would you, how did you start breaking that down where you started the training sort of thing for his mindset so he believed in himself that he was actually that 80 kilo man, not the 130 kilo man?
Yeah, I mean, in his case, unfortunately, we never did quite get around to working through the mindset stuff. We sort of went our separate ways not too long after that experience. So I never quite got the opportunity to dig into it with him. And if I'm completely transparent, it's quite difficult to answer it without like a set person in front of me because everyone is so different. But I guess for him, if I were to work with him, I would start to identify, and this will sound really strange, but I'll start to identify what the benefits of him walking around at 130 kilos are. Because once we start to identify, because we never create anything in our life that we don't feel we gain something from, right? And consciously, you know, we disagree with that. Consciously, we go, well, there's nothing good about being 130 kilos. But unconsciously, we never create anything unless we believe that there's more benefit than loss in that experience. So for him, I would start to get him to bring what's running unconsciously as an unconscious program and make it more of a conscious program. So it could be something as simple as, I know for a lot of men, you know, there's almost like this unconscious belief system that they need to be the protector, right? And so a lot of men choose to be bigger in size because then they're, you know, they're more intimidating, or they feel they're more capable of protecting. You know, you look at the biggest, baddest kind of animals out in the jungles, your gorillas. It's, you know, they're all big animals. So, you know, in his case, it could be a protection thing. It could be that maybe there was some sort of a fear of getting attention. So being bigger, it was his way of actually avoiding attention. It could even be the opposite. It could be that being bigger, he felt like he got more attention. So once we identify what the benefits are, we can then start to come up with another way of getting those same benefits through something that's more aligned with what they actually want. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I actually can completely understand. Like, I'm 6'2" and about 92, 93 kilos. And obviously we're going back to training and stuff, like with all my friends and things like that, I've always been the bigger guy out of my friends. I'm not like overweight or anything like that. I've always kept myself healthy, but my size and stature, I've always been the one that if we've gone out drinking and something's happened, like straight away people have looked at me. Obviously they're not going to look at my 5'2" friends and things yeah. like that. Like if they do, then obviously then they're just going for like the smaller people. But yeah, I can completely understand being the size that I am. But see, like, obviously, like I was saying, now I've gone back to training and things like that. I'm looking at going into, like, jiu-jitsu competitions and stuff. And I've always seen myself as the bigger person as well. Like, but now I've gone training and I've sort of, like, stripped down a little bit and stuff. I'm thinking to myself, like, I could probably get to about 78 kilos. And I could see my, like, my arms and stuff getting smaller and smaller. And it's not a size of, oh, masculinity. I have to be massive. I could see it. And with, like you said, there is benefits to being my size and being smaller and things like that, because when you roll in and you train in jiu-jitsu and stuff like that, you don't have to be massive. I mean, there's plenty of videos on YouTube of bodybuilders going into jiu-jitsu yeah. gyms and getting subbed out and stuff like that, and you can see them just getting angry because of all that testosterone they've got, and they're thinking, well, I'm massive, how can this little skinny 5 foot guy beat me? I'm 6'4" and I'm 20 odd stone and I'm just pure muscle. And they're thinking, how's that? I should be beating this person. But then you're like, but no, they've got the technique. They know how to beat you and use your strength and size against you.
Exactly.
And that's what kind of what jiu-jitsu is, really. You're using your own size and strength, someone else's size and strength against someone.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, great example.
So on the sports side of it, with like with combat sports, obviously we've seen people go from the highest of highs to the lowest of lows, and it's not just the actual fight that you help people with, is it? Obviously you help people with like the weight cut, and you've done your PTs and stuff. Sometimes you might throw some nutrition stuff at them and things like that. How is it for you as a whole, knowing like, even when you see, like, not so much succeed, but say if someone goes on a good run and things like that, and they don't end up getting that title shot, but they're content in how they've performed. I know you've just done a piece with John Wayne Parr, who's unfortunately had to retire through having needed a hip surgery, was it? A hip replacement?
Yeah, yeah.
But he's had that career, and I watched an interview before, obviously, you announced that you were doing the interview with him, or the piece with him. And he was actually really content that he just wanted one more fight before he called it a day. And it's good that obviously he'd got to that point in his life and his career where he thought, you know what, I've won all these belts, I've won all these titles, I'm a recognised name. Is that more self-belief for him than for anyone else to have that one more fight?
To be honest, I mean, and I don't know when you're looking to release this podcast, as to when it's going to time with my releasing the podcast with John Wayne Parr. But for him, he actually, and I feel for the guy, you know, it was a really beautiful moment. He actually disclosed in the episode he did with me that he's not ready to give up, you know, fighting. For him, it was, he's actually said he's really struggling. He's in a very emotionally vulnerable place and feeling quiet. His words, I believe, were depressed because it's not something he's really willing to give up. And unfortunately for him, it's been forced upon him. So he's now in that process of, you know, he's been a fighter his whole life. He before Muay Thai, it was, you know, Taekwondo. So he really doesn't know anything outside of that. So, yeah, I guess he's now in this process of figuring out who the fuck he is if he's not John Wayne Parr, the Muay Thai fighter.
Yeah, and, well, on you saying that, like, we've seen it quite a lot. I know, obviously, pro wrestling's not, obviously, actual fighting, but they are still trained professional athletes, and they are still athletes. And we've seen it so many times where wrestlers have been in the business for 20, 30 years, and then once they get to a point of not being in that, they just disappear. I mean, my biggest one is that I can think of is Diamond Dallas Page, and there's a documentary on him, and he went into drugs and alcohol and stuff like that. And a few other wrestlers that were still in the game like 3 or 4 years after him actually realized, like, holy shit, this guy could kill himself, but he's one of our closest friends. Like, and obviously he kept it from them because he wasn't day to day training, being on the shows, being involved. He never got the opportunity to carry on, whether it be helping other wrestlers or helping other shows and things like that. He just sort of turned his life into sitting at home and drinking and taking drugs and going out partying and stuff like that. And now he's got to the point where he's got probably one of the most successful yoga and spiritual DVDs and franchises out there. And he's probably made more money from that than he did in wrestling.
It's actually amazing that you mentioned that, because I was listening to a book on Audible today called Way of the Superior Man. And so it's by a guy named David Dider. And he was talking about that for a lot of people, martial arts is actually a way of creating freedom. And I was kind of thinking into that, and I guess my experience having worked with so many martial artists is that in most cases is the case. You know, they've grown up feeling trapped, whether that be because they've come from an abusive family dynamic, or whether it be, you know, because they felt like they couldn't express certain emotions, like maybe aggression or anger or, you know, whatever it might be. So they turn to martial arts as a way to gain their power back and to gain that sense of freedom. And so, sadly, we do see a lot of martial artists, when they can no longer fight, they turn to things like alcohol and drugs, because it's almost in a morbid way, a way of actually having a sense of freedom. You know, we think of that feeling with alcohol, it's like it's that numbing sensation, you know, it's like that feeling of freedom. And so it's really nice to hear that in that case, you know, he's found that same sense of freedom through more of a spiritual practice than, you know, even though he has come through that alcohol and drug use, to now find a more constructive outlet.
Yeah, and he's actually helped. There was another wrestler from back in the day, way back in the day when I was a kid, called Jake the Snake, and he went the same way. And they didn't actually know about it. These, like, four friends, I think it was, like, Kevin Nash, Scott Hogan, Dime Dallas Page, and Jake the Snake. They were all really close. They lived quite close to each other. And no one realized that Jake the Snake was going the same way as Diamond Dallas Page. And he said, oh, I've moved away, all this, that, and the other. But he actually hadn't. He just moved to a different block to where they all lived. And now he's in the group as well. And Diamond Dallas Page actually got him and moved him into his house. He says, look, you're not staying in this neighborhood. You're going to come and live with me. I'll feed you. I'll do this and I'll do that. He says, because I want to save your life. And obviously they do, I think it's like Tai Chi, which is the spiritual martial arts and things like that. And all the movement and the mindset and things like that. And he was like, no, come on, man. Like, you're talking shit. Like, this isn't going to work. And he says, look, come stay with me. Even if you stay for a month, he says, I'll get you off drink and I'll get you off drugs. He says, if you don't feel better after a month, he says, you can just leave. He says, I'll let you go. He says, because I know at one point you wanted to die. He said, so
yeah.
I'm going to work with me for a month. He says, if you don't want to do it after that month, he says, I'll let you do your own thing. He says, but I need that chance to try and save your life. And it worked. And now he helps with the program and things like that. And I think he's gave him a percentage of what his actual thing is, because now Jake does like the mindset of it. And they've got a program that they've set up in America to help recovering addicts and stuff.
Wow, that's powerful.
Yeah, so obviously, like, one thing can lead to another. I mean, it's cliche, but I'm in a dad's group on Facebook where obviously dads just go in there, and it's meant to be like they post what they do with their kids and things like that. And the amount of times that men in there, like, obviously it doesn't matter age, size, anything like that, they go through the same struggles. And in this country, dads aren't classed as equal parents. And they say, oh, I've got this going on, I've got that going on, what can help me? And as soon as I see them, straight away, I'm like, take up any martial arts. Find the closest gym to you, whether it be a karate class, a jiu-jitsu class, anything. I said, a karate class, no matter what. I said, once you go to that first class, I said, you might feel shitty and beat up afterwards. I said, but when you go home and you sit and think about it and you think, do you know what? I actually feel real good. Because whether it's an hour class or a 2 hour class or even a half an hour on a treadmill in a gym with some headphones in, all your worries sort of kind of disappear, because you have to focus on what you're doing. Because if you go to a kickboxing class and you're thinking of other things, you're going to get the shit kicked out of you. Like, or you go to a jiu-jitsu class and you're thinking of other stuff. Like, you're just going to end up getting choked out, or you could end up seriously hurt. So you kind of have to think about things and focus what you're actually doing. And martial arts is so much like a drug in itself. Like, people say to me, like, because I'm 31 next month, like, I'm getting on a bit, like, for martial arts. And now I've gone back to training and things like that, because I've done it about 10 years ago. And people are like, oh, so what are you doing it for? And I'm like, I'm super, super competitive. Like, my kids don't even play games with me, like board games and stuff, because I have to win. And they're 11 and 5, and it's horrible. Like, it's probably one of the worst things for me. But I was always brought up that if you're going to do something, you have to do it to win. And or at least to the best of your ability. Like, if I play a football match and we get beat 10-1, but I come off that pitch and I can barely move, I've won. Because I know I've done everything I possibly can. And it's the same with martial arts. Like, I went to the first lesson and I was like, oh, I'm absolutely bad. I could barely move for like 2 days. And then one of my friends was like, you coming back again tonight? And I was like, you know what? Yeah, fuck it. Like, let's go. Like, and then we went. And then he's like, oh, so why are you coming back? And then a couple of my friends from my football team that are going, they're like, oh, so what are you doing this for? And I'm like, I can't help but get this bug out of my head that even if I compete in a jiu-jitsu competition, or if it's one MMA fight or something like that, I have to do something, even if it's just to prove it to myself that I know I can do it. And I suppose, obviously, that's where you, like, what you deal with people on a daily basis, where they set themselves sort of like life goals and they have to do things. But yeah, like I was saying, throughout my whole life, I've had to do stuff where I'm either the best or gave everything to do stuff.
Yeah.
Like, so going back to training and things like that, I'm getting the bug, and my coach is like, you want to fully commit to this, don't you? And I'm like, I'd do anything. Like, like, you genuinely don't understand.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a big believer that, you know, I mean, humans are ultimately animals. And so part of being an animal is that need for, you know, that fight element, that primal need to like test ourselves against a peer. You know, you look at lions; they fight for the what do they call them? The
pride.
Yeah, you know, they fight to be the top of the of the hierarchy, so to speak. And so, I think humans, we have that trait where we want to test ourselves and we want to be able to like pit ourselves against a rival and see who comes out on top, right? And unfortunately, one of the downfalls of like civilization and modern technology and all of those sorts of things is that it's almost made us like lazy, you know, like we never really have that same life or death based challenge. And I think the martial arts is as close as it gets. And so it gives people that outlet to challenge themselves, to pit themselves up against a rival, and I guess like really get back in tune with what it is to actually be an animal, as like bizarre as that sounds. And through that, like, that's when we start to, you know, I mean, that's why this is why I believe that martial arts is such a heavily, generally speaking, heavily growth focused or self development focused sport, because, you know, we get to meet, we get to notice those holes in our game, we get to notice what our weaknesses are, and so through that we get to then go, okay, well, how can I get that 1% better? How can I be that 1% better than my opponent? How can I be that 1% better than myself? So yeah, I mean, that's the power of martial arts. And as you said, I think that everyone should take up some sort of martial arts for that exact reason, because it's a really powerful way to get out of things like depression and mental illness, because you know, when we're competing in any sort of combat sport, or even just training in any sort of combat sport, that more primal need to just survive pops up, and then we don't have time for, like, I'm going to call them silly concerns. That's not to say that's always the case, but, you know, those things, we don't have time to overthink because we're just focused on surviving.
Yeah, and like I was saying, obviously, like, if you go to a kickboxing class and you're thinking, oh, what am I going to do tomorrow, or have I done my paperwork at work, or have I done this or done that? By the time you were sitting thinking about that, you've got someone in front of you trying to kick your head off or punch your face in.
Exactly.
And the same with jiu-jitsu, like, you're going to lose an arm or a leg, or or someone's going to be wrapped around your neck. And it gives you that point where you have to think, do you know what? It's either, and it's like what like pro athletes say, you can't, with MMA, you can't be half in and half out. Like, because if you're thinking of retirement or you're thinking of something else, whilst you're there, you're not giving your 100% to training, to dieting, to your mindset, to your performance. And then when you get there, like, if you're thinking, do you know what, I'm going to enjoy this sunset retirement or this, that and the other, and you're going into your last fight, you could end up dying, essentially. Like, you could potentially be killed. So, one of my friends, he's saying, he's gone to training with me as well, and he's got a real big bug for it. Like, he's constantly texting me every day, like, oh, where can we go and train? Where can we do this and where can we do that? Like you were saying, he wants to get that, like, 1% better every day, because he's going to the classes to learn the jiu-jitsu and things like that, and I can see the frustration in him whilst he's doing it and stuff, because people are subbing him and stuff like that. But then he, like, takes a couple of seconds, then he realises, you know what, these people are more advanced at this than me. He's literally... we've done it for 3 weeks, I think it is, 2 or 3 weeks. And then he realizes, do you know what? Like, I need to stop beating myself up, because I've only done it for 3 weeks, yet the people we train with have done it, I think the minimum one's done it for about a year. And so they know, obviously, like, the techniques, how to use the strengths and stuff like that. So, and then he realizes, like, do you know what? Like, I'm being harsh on myself, but I can still see that frustration, and I completely understand his frustration of thinking, do you know what, I fucking hate this, like, I'm getting subbed left, right and center. But then he realizes to himself, like, I just want to get better, and I know I'm getting better, and I'm knowing I'm learning techniques, and I'm doing this and I'm doing that. And you can see it, and it's a good process that you can see other people doing it, and I do it myself. Like, man, I hate getting submitted in jiu-jitsu, but it's one of them things, you know, you kind of learn from your mistakes, otherwise it happens again.
Exactly, it's, you know, it's one of those sports where it's it's obviously so physically based, but I mean, as you said, you can't, your mind can't be elsewhere when you're, you know, when you've got someone trying to snap your arm off or punch you in the face. And so it really is, you know, I call it, I think it's the most, you know, intense sport in the world. I think it's the most, it's the sport you have to be the most on point or the most optimized in, because it requires you to be mentally there, it requires you to be physically there, it requires you to be technically there. You know, in a lot of cases, sports like jiu-jitsu, you can't, it's very rare to have someone who's just naturally gifted at the sport, because it's so technically focused, and there's so much around, you know, you've got to be able to recall techniques and memorize techniques and, you know, I guess be a little bit more, I'm going to use the word academically minded. And you also then have to have the emotional ability or the emotional intelligence to be able to deal with, like, pressure and fear and, you know, all those other sorts of things that come as a result of having someone who's literally there trying to, you know, knock your block off. So yeah, it really is. It's a whole different sport in comparison to, you know, and I love all sports, but compared to, you know, say tennis or something like that, it really requires that next level.
Yeah, and I think that kind of the majority of it comes down to, like people say, it's the most selfish sport possible. Mm-hmm. Like, because you sacrifice so much when you do like a 12-week training camp. Obviously your first few weeks, obviously you can still go see your family and friends, but a lot of the top guys obviously and gals go to different camps and stuff, and they go and stay at gyms and things like that. I mean, I know Juan Adams, who's in the UFC, who fights this weekend, he's just moved from somewhere to Albuquerque, New Mexico, to fight at Jackson, to train at Jackson Wink with John Jones and things like that, and he's actually living in the gym and stuff like that. But he's taken himself from everything he's had, like his friends, his family, his general day-to-day life, to go and live in a gym. And that plays a massive part just on his mindset. And when he's got to now, like with his training camp and his dieting and things like that, he actually posted it on Facebook that someone else was going to be in control of his Facebook for the last 3 weeks of his camp, and that he wasn't going to be replying to anyone, or if anyone messages him on the last week when he's doing his water cut and things like that, because it takes it away from your mind. And he doesn't, not in a sense, doesn't want to upset people, but he doesn't want to give people the wrong impression of him. So obviously if you've just found out who he is and you message him saying, oh, hey man, good luck for the weekend, all this, that, and the other, and he turns, like, he's had a bad day with his water cut or bad day at training, he turns around, oh, fuck off mate, like, blah, 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 blah. So he says, like, I'm not going to reply to people the last week, because he wants to get himself fight focused, ready, and things like that, and obviously make sure he's 100% dedicated to his weight cut and things like that, and he's ready for fight week.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the 1% difference that makes a difference in terms of combat sport. You know, people don't consider how much something as simple as, you know, if an athlete's had an argument with their partner the night before the fight, you know, and they walk out to that fight worried about, it may not necessarily be like the conscious thought or the thought that's like right at the forefront of their mind, but somewhere in the background, that's taking up emotional energy. And I know that out of all the organs, it's actually our mind that uses, that expends the most energy. And so if we imagine that the mind's got things outside of like the task ahead of us, like, you know, in this case, the fight, if the mind's focusing on things like, you know, this argument with their partner the night before, or I don't know, whether or not we've got enough money to fund the flight home, or whatever it might be, I'm just making things up here, but if the brain's got that going on and trying to figure that out in the background, even if it's not necessarily a conscious thought, that's actually going to lead to having athletes gas, or, you know, they're going to fatigue quicker, or they're not going to perform as well, because the mind isn't all streamlined towards that one end goal. And so it's so important to make sure that, you know, everything's in check, all aspects of life, not only like the fight relevant stuff, like the nutrition, the sleep, the recovery, the training, all of that, but also the stuff like the relationship, the finances, the, you know, the side job, or, you know, all aspects.
Yeah, it's obviously funny you saying, like, obviously if you train with your partner and things like that, I follow Paige VanZant and her husband Austin on Instagram, and they actually don't corner each other, which is good. Yeah. And they train together and things like that. But when they go to the gym, they train separate. They do like a few training sessions at the home together, like a few light pads, kettlebells, just a workout session and stuff like that. It's never fully MMA related when they go home. They do it to have fun. And I think, like, it like you were saying, it's tough. Like, even if you have a dispute whilst you're at home and stuff like that, if you train with your partner and they corner you and things like that, that could take unnecessary energy that you don't need to take away from things like that. And I think they've got kind of a good balance of how they do it. Like, I think Austin's last fight, Paige VanZant actually sat in the crowd and didn't even corner him. And then when he won, she came into the cage. But then he corners her, but he's like the fourth person, not the first three.
Yeah.
It's giving that other person the motivation and everything like that, knowing that they're there. And they don't ever seem to talk about, when they do their Instagram stories together and things like that, they don't ever say, oh, like, your last fight was shit, blah, 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 you should have done this, you should have done that. Obviously, we don't see everything that goes on behind closed doors. But to the public eye, they keep everything strictly professional, which is good. And it shows when they use their energy and full focus on fight days.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, to be honest, I can't comment too much on them because I haven't followed a whole lot of their journey. But I mean, I've seen them train together, you know, in their videos. As you said, they're little, like, at home just for fun workouts. But other than that, I haven't looked too deeply into their dynamic. But yeah, I mean, they're a prime example of, you know, I think they've played that well by not cornering each other.
Yeah. I actually had someone else. I've got to follow someone else who's a kickboxer, a female kickboxer, on Facebook, and her husband as well. And he corners her as well. And he actually put a post out yesterday, and he said, because she won a competition yesterday, she'd done three fights in one night. And he said, it's so hard for me to separate being a husband to being a coach. He says, but now we've got to the point from when we get home and stuff like that, I'm just a husband. So as soon as the fight's done, I'm a husband. And then when we get ready for the next one, I'm a coach.
Absolutely. I mean, even for me, I've had the pleasure of cornering some of my clients. I've had, and you know, many of my clients are really close friends as well. I have a bit of a rule that I don't work with anyone that I wouldn't want to actually hang out with as friends. And so even for me, I mean, it's at times I struggle to put that separation there through, you know, being really good friends with someone and as a friend wanting them to do well versus that slight detachment of being a coach and wanting them to do well from a coach perspective. So, yeah, you know, it's a really important balancing point. And, I mean, even for me, I always do the mindset work myself when it comes to having clients fight, when I'm going to support any client in, you know, their competition. I always make sure to do the mindset work on myself to make sure that I don't then accidentally impact their performance through, you know, getting too emotional or too nervous beforehand or putting too much pressure on them or whatever it might be. So I think it's a fine balance, and it's something that coaches need to be aware of, their cornermen need to be aware of, you know, obviously the athletes need to be aware of, and be able to communicate. You know, I had a conversation with a client actually not too long ago, and he was saying that for him, the toughest bit about any fight is actually the walkout, because for him, he feels a sense of pressure when he knows there's people he knows in the crowd. And so when it comes to the walkout, he tries not to look around too much, because if he sees that, you know, his mom or his siblings are in the crowd or whatever, it actually throws him off and impacts his performance. And so something like that, for him, I would recommend to him to go and actually have a conversation with them and explain that to them and say, I need you to make sure that I don't see you. You know, I need you to make sure that you're at the back of the room or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's all good, fine and well, your family being like front row and watching it in the action. Yeah. But with him, like, it'd probably be better if they're up in the roof, like watching it on the big screens, or in the bar watching it, like on the TV screens, for his personal own performance.
Exactly. So, I mean, these are all things that, you know, most coaches, most friends, most cornermen don't actually consider, most fighters don't actually consider. And so it's really important, as I said, to have every aspect of your life to first of all know when you do and don't perform at your best, and then also to then like make sure that everyone's on the same page and knows exactly what you need, and to have it all individualized so that there's no accidental fuck ups.
Yeah, it's like when you said about, obviously, like there's a fine line of excuse me, of not wanting to hang out with people that you'd obviously that you work with, that, or you don't work with them because you want to be friends with them and things like that. And I actually watched someone, another journalist, I'm not going to mention his name, do a YouTube show, and he said, anyone's like, oh, have you got any advice for aspiring MMA journalists and things like that? And he said, yeah, don't make things too personal. He says, don't take pictures with fighters, etc., etc. And that caught, kind of, not ticked me off, but I looked at it the other way. Yeah. For me, first and foremost, under no matter what, I am a fight fan. So I've had fighters, like, it's still crazy to me now that I've got people that are in the UFC and Bellator and Cage Warriors all around the world. People like yourself in Australia that want to talk to me and be a part of what I'm trying to grow. And yet I'm still a fan of these people. And yet,
yeah,
like, I went to Bellator a few weeks ago, and one of the officials was like, oh, yeah, I tried to get in a picture with MVP, because he was standing in the media area. And I was like, oh, MVP, can I get a picture? And this media guy came out of nowhere, and he was like, no, you're media, you're not allowed to come, you're not allowed a picture with him, all this, that, and the other. I was like, why? He was like, because you could be biased, all this, that, and the other. I was like, his opponent's over there. I said, I'll go and get a picture with his opponent if you want. Like, I'm not biased whatsoever. I said, I know his opponent. I'll genuinely go and take a picture with his opponent. And the best example of it was, like, I spoke to Soren Back a few times, who used to fight for Cage Warriors, and I actually spoke to him as soon as he'd left the cage when he fought last year in Liverpool, and he won the title against Paddy Pimblett, and he'd come to enemy territory and everything like that. There was like 4,000 people in the crowd, most of them were Liverpudlians, chanting for the hometown guy, and I sat up in the stands, managed to get my way down to the crowd, and he sort of jumped on me. He was like, oh, Scott, like, it's great to see you. And I was like, holy shit, like, he remembered my name, like, you've just gone 25 minutes, like, what the fuck? Like, wow. But then I met him at Bellator a couple of months ago, and I was standing talking to him, and Dan Hardy was standing behind us, and Soren Back fought Dan Hardy's teammate, and like, so I took a picture with Soren, I was standing talking to him, I'd done all the media with him, and then I started talking to Dan as well, and Dan had obviously separated that even though I spoke to Dan, to Soren, he wasn't fighting Soren. It wasn't actually Dan v Soren. So even though he'd fought his teammate, Dan was like, do you know what, he's doing his job, like, obviously seeing me doing my job, trying to talk to Soren and keeping it there. But I like to keep things on a level of personal sort of thing, because, like I said, I'm a fight fan. So especially with the amateur guys, like, if I can make it personal with anyone, and then someone gets that big contract and stuff like that, and I interview them every amateur fight they've had, or give them promotion for any of their training and things like that, and then all of a sudden, like, they get signed to the UFC or they get signed to Bellator and stuff, and then people are asking them for interviews and stuff, they potentially could give me exclusives, which
exactly.
Is
yeah.
And for me, that's like, oh wow, like, I've got an exclusive, holy shit, like, I was the first to know, or they told me second or anything like that. But for them to come out and wait for me to tell them, like, I've had fighters wait to release press fight news because they wanted to do it on my show, which for me is massive, because obviously I'm excited to watch these fighters fight because I'm a fight fan. But then obviously, like you were saying, the fine line of keeping it personal and professional, like, I do it all the time with my UFC picks. Like, when I post on Twitter, everyone's like, oh, who are you going for this weekend? And I'm like, well, I spoke to this guy 4 times, and this guy basically told me to fuck off when I asked him for an interview. So I'm going for this guy.
It's bizarre. I remember having a phone conversation with Alistair Overeem, and I remember, you know, keeping the conversation really, you know, just like business focused, and, you know, just all about, this was, the conversation was just after he'd been knocked out by Ngannou.
Oh, right.
And so, you know, having this conversation with him about, you know, how he can sort of, you know, make a comeback from that, and like changes he could make and whatever else. And then I remember as soon as we hung up the phone, I ran in, I was staying at my brother's house at that time, because I was mid-traveling. And I remember running into my brother's room and, you know, saying, oh, my God, you know who I just got off the fucking phone from? And he's not a combat sports fan at all. So, you know, when I said Alistair Overeem, he's like, yeah, I don't know who that is. But, you know, just that thing of like, wow, like this is one of the UFC's biggest names. Yeah, it was huge for me. So, I mean, I think that's the difference between someone who's good at their job and someone who's great at their job, because when they actually really fucking care and it really means something to them, you know, they pour that little bit extra into it. So, yeah, I mean, it's I think it's important to have that deeper connection than just doing your job.
Yeah, it's like what you're saying, where, like, obviously you ran in the room afterwards and you were like, oh, my God, I spoke to him. Like, I spoke to the majority of the Ultimate Fighter series from the Tough series, from They Were All Undefeated. Yep. And obviously, I spoke to a few of them more than what they have. Some of them now have got the Conor McGregor effect, and make you talk to their managers, which is another story. And,
yeah,
like, a few of them, like, they're just so down to earth. Like, one of them, like, he's probably the nicest guy I think I've ever spoke to, and that's Jay Cuccinello. Mm-hmm. And he's got probably one of the strongest minds I've ever met. Like, one of his fights, he lives in Spain. And he got a phone call 2 hours before he was meant to fight in Spain to say that his brother had died. And he actually went and carried on and fought and won and still ended up undefeated. And
yeah,
he obviously went into the Tough House and I spoke to him afterwards, and he's gone into bare knuckle and things like that. And, like, he come over to England to do seminars and stuff like that. So I said to him, like, I just dropped him a message saying, oh, look, you're only, like, 45-minute drive away from me. Any way I could get you to come over, like, do a meet and greet with people, like, I'll try and pay you, I'll try and set something up, all this, that, and the other. And he just replied saying, yeah, we could try and make that work, all this, that, and the other, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what? He was like, yeah, we'll make that work. And I was like, and then he messaged me, like, a couple of hours later, and he says, even better, Scott, he says, get your camera ready, get yourself over to here, he says, and we'll go for lunch and stuff, and we'll just do a day together. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, I watch you on TV, and you've just invited me out to lunch, like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, but yeah, like, it's crazy. And for me, like, I'm a kid at Christmas. Like, someone messages me back and they say, oh, yeah, let's do an interview. And I'm like, oh, oh my God, like, let's go. And then now it's become bigger over here in the UK. Like, my football team and stuff like that are like, have you spoke to Conor McGregor yet? Have you spoke to Brock Lesnar? No. And I probably won't, like, because they only speak to ESPN and Ariel Helwani, and I'm neither of them. Like... So, and then when I mention names and stuff, and they say, do you know this, this person, that person, like, when they watched the Conor McGregor card, obviously I've spoke to Saduq Yusuf and things like that, and people that were on that card, and they were like, oh, that's going to be a banging fight. And I was like, yeah, I was speaking to him, like, last week, and they were like, what? I was like, yeah, like, I dropped him a message to say, like, oh, I hope everything's going good with the camp, hope everything's all right, hope training's going good. And they're like...
He's lovely, by the way.
Yeah, and he's an absolute animal. Like... I spoke to him just after his Contender Series fight, and he's such a humble guy. Like, he didn't even realise that you could do a Facebook Live so we could talk to each other, like, halfway around the world on a phone. And he actually stood out in the rain for, like, 25 minutes talking to me on his phone, because he was, like, he was amazed that he could do that. And then he was like, oh, wow, like, I can do this. Like, because he's come from humble beginnings, and he's still there now. Obviously, he's trying to get his mum over from Nigeria and the rest of his family and things like that. But, yeah, he's a killer. He's going to be a future champ. And he's only 25 as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But but people say, what about this person and that person? I'm like, yeah, like, I can speak to these people. Like, I was speaking to Gerald Meerschaert, who trains at Rufus Sport with Tyron Woodley, Ben Askren, Anthony Pettis, Sergio Pettis. And I was speaking to him the night of the fights, and I was like, oh, I bet you, and Macy Barber as well. I said, oh, I bet you're excited and nervous about this. And he was like, I'm absolutely terrified. Like, because obviously it's his teammate. And that's another thing that people don't realize. Like, even though it's your teammate, like, and you're not fighting, you could still feel exactly the same, because you know how that person, you know how that person's feeling going into that fight. And you want to do everything you possibly can to try and help them in that fight, but you can't, you've got to sit on the sidelines and watch.
Yeah, and I think that's a huge element of it. You know, obviously, when you're the one fighting, it's somewhat within your, or it's obviously a lot more in your control, how it does pan out. Whereas, you know, when you're on the sidelines, when you're cornering or watching, it's, you know, you just basically give them a hug and then wish them all the best and hope that, you know, your instructions from the corner or whatever get them over the line.
Yeah, and I suppose, obviously, like with your line of work with the mindset and stuff, it works just as much for corner men as it does for the actual fighters. I mean, corner men put in so much time and effort, and it's not just with one person. They could have a squad of 20 fighters that are all in top promotions or starting their careers, so they have to worry about everyone and not just that one person on the night.
Yeah, I mean, I wholeheartedly believe that coaches should be getting mindset coaching, cornermen should be getting mindset coaching, the athletes should be getting mindset coaching, you know, because, yeah, the more, as I keep saying, the more aligned we all are, the more we understand how one another performs best and, you know, what triggers our peak performance versus what detracts from it, the more, you know, we can, build these super athletes. I've lost track of how many times I've witnessed cornermen, more so on the obviously the local scene, more so than the elite scene, but the amount of times I've witnessed cornermen doing something in between rounds or saying something in between rounds where I'm like, you've just fucked that guy, you know, when he goes out for that next round, he's going to be way more fatigued than he should be because, you know, you did this instead of this, you know, and I think that's obviously it's not intentional because the cornermen want what's best for the individual athlete. It's just ignorance or it's, you know, just not knowing any better.
Yeah, it's like you're saying that obviously within between rounds. So going back to obviously Sadiq Youssef when he fought Andre Feely. Andre Feely's corner turned around and said to him in between going into the third that it was one each. And that kind of, he picked up the pace a little bit, and I think Sadiq Youssef's corner done it a little wrong because they told him he was 2-0 up, so he tried to coast that last round. Obviously he was 2-0 up, but they fucked up by saying he was 2-0 up. They should have said to him, it's one each, you need to go out and win this round. Him coasting, he almost lost, well, I think he almost lost that last round. So if it was one each going into it, he didn't know that. He thought he was 2-0 up. So he went in there saying, oh, I could lose this round. As long as I don't get finished, I've won this fight. Instead of saying, oh, it's one each, pull your fucking finger out.
Exactly, yeah. He went in there to play not to lose, rather than play to win.
Yeah, and that's a big thing for people when they play to, like, to not get finished and instead of playing to win.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, I think it's so important as coaches to understand and as cornermen to understand how an individual athlete processes a fight. Because, you know, obviously in a sport like MMA, there's so much external stimulus going on. You know, it's a very fast-moving sport. There's, you know, especially with the more elite levels of the sport, you know, you've got the UFC where you've got the cameras in your face, you've got the crowd, you've got people booing, you've got, you know, all the lights, you've got all these other things to deal with. So it's a sport where it's easy to get overwhelmed, and someone who's maybe not so good at taking processing a lot of information all at once, if a cornerman doesn't know how to actually deal with that in between rounds, then they go and add, you know, all this extra information, or they're yelling at their fighter, or they're, you know, giving them heaps of, you know, different instructions, then that just leads to the fighter going out there even more fatigued than at the end of the previous round, because they're trying to process all this extra stuff and their brain's ultimately in overdrive, which then has an impact on the body as well. So
yeah,
so important to understand how an individual processes the world.
Yeah, we've seen it a few times where, especially in like the UFC, where people have gone back to their corner and then you've got one coach saying this, another coach saying this, like another one trying to fix, like, whether it be a leg injury or from leg kicks or something like that. And then you've got the guy outside the cage saying, oh, you need to do this, you need this. And there's so many people talking at one time, and you're just thinking, like, just shut the fuck up and let them have 10 seconds to clear their head. Like, let them try and figure out that round for themselves. Yes, you've seen it from the outside, but they could be feeling a lot worse or a lot better than what you're actually thinking that they are. Like, they could be seriously hurt, and you're thinking that they're all right because they haven't taken many shots, or you could think that they're injured when they're not. They feel perfectly fine after that round, and yet everyone's screaming information at them, and you're just thinking, like, wow, how are you possibly meant to take all that in 30 seconds of analysing a round and getting a game plan for the next round?
Absolutely. I think, you know, more than anything, in most cases, the, you know, the break in between rounds is about just recentering the person, getting them back into their body, getting them back to breathing and, you know, just getting their breath back rather than, you know, being having this exerted breath going on. And then maybe giving them one or two main instructions, and then just, you know, the work's done. Everything that the fighter is going to do during a fight, that's all for before the fight, you know. That's all stuff that needs to kind of be in place. And obviously that does change throughout a fight, but unfortunately, you know, humans can only take on so much information at once. So to overload them in between rounds is just not... it's just poor practice, you know?
Yeah, and hopefully that's something that a lot more coaches realise, that if your head coach is the one that's cornering you, that's the one that talks, whether they pass the information to him or her, and it goes through that one person, because like you said, the human brain can only take on so much information at one time.
Exactly. Yeah, and especially, I mean, if we're starting to gas out, if we're fatigued physically, then our ability to take on details is limited even more than that. So sorry, you'll have to excuse the dog barking. ability to take on information is even more compromised because we're already physically exerted. So the more we can kind of take someone in between rounds and just focus on, like, right, you know, I need you to put your hands on my shoulders so that then they're, like, anchored back in their body, they're back in the present moment. You know you've got their attention. Maybe get them to take, you know, three big, deep breaths so that then they start to actually, you know, their nervous system starts to recalibrate, they start to come back into a recovery space rather than, you know, a stress response. Like I said, maybe give them, like, one or two key bits of information rather than, you know, the stuff that we hear, which is like, right, I need you to, you know, jab, cross, kick, and then he does this, and I need you to weave and then go for the takedown and then, you know, get an armbar or whatever it might be, you know?
Yeah, it's one of them that some people work better with it and some don't. Like, you see some coaches just go into the corner, like, second round, like, you need to fucking finish them. Straight up, like, nothing else. You need to finish them. Like, it's kill or be killed. Like, you're going out there to put every single last bit on the line. Like, finish it or you've lost the fight. And you see fighters that no end of times that go out there and just think, you know what, fuck. Like, you see them and they go out there and end up winning the rounds and you're thinking, like, that's the advice I should have got the first round. Like, give me that at the start of the fight.
Yeah. I mean, my favourite is when you see coaches actually, like, they make their athlete laugh, you know, and that immediately brings them back to their body. His name's completely just escaped my mind, but I remember watching an old fight with Donald Cerrone, Cowboy, and his coach, he's come back into the corner and his coach has just immediately sat him down and he's gone, get some, Donald Cerrone. And, you know, got a bit of a smirk from Cowboy, and something like that, something super simple like that, it immediately just brings you, like, straight back to the present moment, you know? You're no longer, obviously there's still a degree of, like, processing whatever has just happened, but it kind of brings you back rather than being in that place of complete mental overdrive.
Yeah, and like you're saying, that's kind of sometimes all you need is to bring you back down, in a sense, bring you back down to earth to realise that you are still a human being. Like, and as cliche and as old as it sounds, like, people perform better when they're having fun and they're more relaxed. Like, we're not robots, so people were like...
Exactly.
They try and say, oh, you have to do this and you have to do this, and, like, give them 12 instructions, like you were saying, jab, like, do the jab, do the cross, then go for the takedown or the sandy, and you're thinking, like, it's better if you just let them flow and, like, you're having fun and you're relaxed. Like, if things happen, they're going to happen. Obviously, you can't force things in MMA. Like, obviously, you can force people to go a certain way, but then they could think, well, I ain't going that way. And then they do your game plan on you. And
yeah.
But giving them that freedom to, because like you're saying, a perfect example is Donald Cerrone. I've only seen a few fights where his coach has said, right, we need to do a little bit more of this and a little bit less of that. Like, the rest of them, they just sit in there and they say, feeling good? How are you? Like, you good? Like, just keep going. Just keep going. Just keep doing you.
Exactly. And I mean, the thing is as well, like, when we're fatigued, we naturally go back to what's most basic and what's most comfortable. So it doesn't matter how heavily we train a technique or we train a setup or anything like that. When we're gassing out, like, the first thing we want to go back to is whatever comes naturally, whether that's like a jab cross kick or, you know, whether that's going for a takedown, whatever it might be. When we're stressed or when we're fatigued, like, we go all the way back to basics. And so when you've got your coach, you know, trying to say to you, like, right, I need you to do this setup, and your body's just pretty much just running on straight instinct and straight adrenaline, to try and, like, fight it, to recall what your coach wants you to do and then execute it, it's such a big ask. It's almost impossible, you know?
And it's probably one of the reasons why people love the fight game, because there's so many things, a different aspect of what could go wrong and what can go right and what you can control and what you can't. Like we were saying before, like, it's addictive because you have to get your brain thinking as much as your legs and your arms, like, and your elbows. It's full on. Like, and when people say, like, they've gone to an hour of jiu-jitsu or they've gone to an hour of kickboxing and they're just like, I'm just tired. Like, I just want to go to sleep. Like, I went to open mat on Friday and my brain felt so tired because the people that I was rolling with were way more advanced than me. But, like, my legs and my arms, I was like, do you know what? I could go for a run or something like that. And my head was like, no, we ain't going anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favourite examples is Conor McGregor versus Nate Diaz, the first fight. I hear so many people make comments about, I remember Conor, I think he went for that takedown. He was getting hit by shots pretty heavily, went for a takedown, and then obviously that led to getting tapped out. And, you know, so many people are like, what a fucking idiot. Like, you know, who does he think he is trying to, you know, like, play a ground game with someone of Nate Diaz's, you know, grappling ability. But, I mean, you look at everything that played out, there was a clear moment where Conor started to panic. His stress response kicked in, and I'm going to assume that against a lesser grappler, like, that's his natural go-to to escape copping too many shots, he goes for a takedown. And so, you know, in that moment, and we can literally see the exact moment on his face, he just, you know, he went for what came most naturally, and that was to just escape being in a position where he could continue taking shots. So he went for the takedown, and of course we know how that played out. But it's funny to witness so many people, you know, really rubbish him for that and say, you know, what the fuck was he thinking? But when it comes down to it, he literally wasn't thinking, you know.
Yeah.
He was literally running on pure adrenaline, pure, like, defense mechanism, pure stress response, you know. So that's one of those things that we really have to take into account when it comes to athletes and particularly combat sports athletes, because we're basically fighting the body's natural protective mechanisms.
Yeah, and it, like you're saying, if he'd have got that takedown, he could have got that takedown, even for a 20-second breather, that could have made him last till the end of that round. And
exactly.
Even if he just got to the ground and held Nate Diaz there and thought, you know what, I can last here for 20 seconds, I can get a bit of breath back, I could probably stand up and get out of this and get to the end of the round.
Exactly, yeah.
And he kind of had that mindset of thinking, do you know what? It's not working standing up, so I'm going to have to try and take it to the ground. It's like game plan A and game plan B.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I know it's getting late over there. I think it's about 9:30 at night.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, so it's, like I said, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It's always great to hear a different side of just punching people in the face and what goes on behind them and things like that, and how people recover and things like that, and what actually goes through their heads whilst training to punch people in the face.
The time has flown. It's been it's a good conversation when it feels like you've only been chatting for about 15 minutes. And I just looked and we're at an hour five. So, yeah, it's been a good chat.
Yeah, like I said, it's always a pleasure. Hopefully we can do it again soon.
Absolutely, I'd love to.
Want to give any shout outs? Obviously, like, I know you do other stuff outside of the combat stuff, any of your pages or anything like that, then fire away.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess if people want to follow me on social media, they can do so by searching my name, BRIANABOWLEY. That's on both Facebook and Instagram. Otherwise, I've got my podcast, The Live Free Experience, which has quite a heavy combat sports underlying kind of vibe. So that's available on all your favorite podcasting platforms. Other than that, I think that's it, really.
Good stuff. I just want to give a few shout outs to XS Mouth Guards, keeping my teeth in my mouth whilst I'm back training, keeping me pretty, as always. Tasteless Tees, go and check them out. They've done my logo. Great stuff. They've got some new stuff coming as well. Ultimate Fighting Outlet, just provided me with my new shorts. And CBD Life UK. And go and check out Fightbook MMA. We've got some big things coming this year as well. Again, it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Hopefully we can do it again soon.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been a blast.
I'm glad we could finally get it done. It's been a while, about 9 months in the making.
Yeah, we've kind of just kept missing each other, right?
Yeah.
The joys of living on opposite sides of the world.
Exactly. But yeah, thank you very much, and I'll let you go and enjoy the rest of your night.
All right. Thank you. You have a good one.